Well, good afternoon. It's the 4th of December 2007, and I'm with Kurt Ehr from the Head of International Academy and NPIA, National Policing Improvement Agency in the United Kingdom. Before I begin the interview, Kurt, I just want to confirm that you have had the opportunity to read and that you have signed the release forms in connection with this project.
Yeah, I've both read and signed the various documents.
Okay, thank you. Well, then, with your permission, I'll begin the interview now.
Sure.
I'd like to begin, first of all, by asking you what your job entails as Head of International Academy of the National Policing Improvement Agency, and maybe talk a little bit about your career journey, how you came from starting off to where you are now.
No problem, Gordon. Starting with the Academy itself and my position there, as Head of the International Academy at Brams Hill, we've just recently merged into the new National Policing Improvements Agency, so just to get that clarified, which is a new institution agency that was set up on the 1st of April this year. The role specifically of the International Academy and my bit within it is that we provide UK-based leadership programs for police, senior police officers of moving up to the executive level. So what we call high potentials. So we run a series of programs in the UK for those officers, usually of the rank of chief inspector up to superintendent. And that particular program is called the International Commanders Program. But I'm also responsible here in the UK for the running of the International Strategic Leadership Program, again, which is this time aimed specifically for those officers moving up to the executive level, up to chief officer rank. And we've been running those programs for the last few years at the college. So that's the UK function of the academy. But to the same degree, I have an advisory unit, which is made up of five international policing advisors, all uniformed superintendents, so senior ranked police officers, representing the five regions of the world as we've established it. That is Asia Pacific, including China, Europe, Middle East, North Africa, Africa, and also Latin America, Caribbean. And those five policing advisors also help develop and provide leadership programs and facilitate the development of leadership training programs within countries and regions around the world. But they also provide advice in helping establish other forms of training programs, so bespoke training program in the context of whatever the local requirement is. And again, typically those kind of areas of police training engagement that we're involved in overseas include community policing, public order or critical incident command training, investigations, so all levels of investigative police training. We do a lot around intelligence within the policing context, and we're also involved in areas such as forensics, scenes of crime, and more increasingly and interestingly, we're getting asked to help with the development of policing HR programs, human resource programs overseas, as part of a capacity building approach. So in summary, the two key areas I'm responsible for are the traditional and world-renowned leadership programs run at Brams Hill here in the UK, but more increasingly now we're involved in providing external support to improving policing internationally, and much of that is in support of both Foreign Office, UK Foreign Office, and Department for International Development objectives.
Thank you. And how did you come to be in this position? What was your career trajectory about, and what were some of the skills that you brought to the position that you're in currently?
I think it all started when I was born, in the sense that I was actually born in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and found myself travelling as a child extensively at an early age, ending up living in the UK. My father was from the Caribbean and my mother was actually from Africa. So I think right at the outset, I had that sort of an international dimension to my life. But the key starting point has to be when I joined the Royal Marines in 89, because straight away, again, I was engaged in a number of exercises and operations internationally. And at the same time, at the latter stages of that phase in my life, because I did what they call a short career extension, which I did my sort of 10 years in the service, the last job was actually commanding the junior command course. So that's where I first got involved in the leadership and training environment. And it was from there, really, that I didn't want to be full career in the forces. And it was not long after that that I was involved in some leadership consultancy in the commercial sector, eventually joining Ashridge Business School, where I sort of cut my teeth in terms of getting more into the concept of consultancy, organisational change and personal development. Actually, in the context of what drives me, the values that drive me, discovered that I was really hankered to get back into public service, because even in the business school environment, it was very commercially driven. So made the decision back in 2004 when an opportunity, because I was aware of policing, actually had thought about it for myself early on, but there was an opportunity to join the then UK Central Police Training Development Authority, which was called Centrex, and in particular the international faculty, as an international training coordinator or project manager. And I think you probably see from that where I kind of put together sort of my practical skills, and was fortunate enough at the time, because of course I was a civilian, to get through the civil service interview process, not being uniformed, of which I was the first person to actually get through that as a civilian member of staff, and sort of haven't looked back since.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about context, about how you become aware of the context in which you work in. And by that I mean the context in which you work overseas, but also the context of the UK government's various arms and agencies that are involved in policing. So to begin with, first by talking about the context in which you work overseas, you mentioned some of the areas in which you coordinate with the training advisors: Asia Pacific, Europe, Middle East, North Africa, Africa and Latin America. Extremely large, extremely complex, extremely diverse regions. How do you as an individual come to get situational awareness of the specific context in which you're working in order to inform and shape the training programs in which you develop?
I think, again, the starting point in this respect, and this is one where I have to tell it how it is that the original context for UK police training to be involved internationally was based loosely around what was on the shelf, what was available at short notice, and to a degree was income generation. In other words, there was this notion internationally, and in particular the context with the Commonwealth, former Commonwealth countries. So to start with, our roots lay in supporting the development of UK Commonwealth partners or former Commonwealth countries in terms of developing their police officers and their police leaders. So that's where it all started. And because there were no processes, it was very much a case of, well, Brams Hill is internationally renowned. Whilst we've been sending officers to you in the UK, would you mind starting to think about ways in which you can support us over here? And in particular, that story started with those very officers themselves, because once they went back to their countries, they then themselves started asking, could you come and help me develop my own critical incident command capability? I'm a bit concerned about this murder. I think we need to do some training in this respect. So it was very much that sort of alumni that we had developed that themselves was now providing the impetus for UK police training, as it was, to be called forward. Initially, it started very much locally in terms of Europe. It tended to start with Europe and the Caribbean and then Africa. So those tended to be the sort of the Commonwealth connections. And as I alluded to just prior to this, is that much of our response was, well, what was available from a UK policing perspective, irrespective of whether it was the Sussex Critical Incident Command policy or not, we just pulled it off the shelf, gave it to some officer that was available or member of staff from the organisation, and off they went. We didn't know, you know, how to recover cost, whether we were going to be charging for it, et cetera, So the whole thing was very loose and it was very prescriptive from a UK perspective. So the context, there was no context. It was very inaccurate and it was based loosely on relationships with those officers. What then happened, and I referred to it initially, was this issue around income. Once we then started to realise that we had an opportunity to charge for some of these services in terms of abstraction cost, which was fine initially, but then what was being looked at, well, this is a really useful opportunity for the organisation to offer up its expertise, charge for it and create a nice little bit of income for the organisation, which it wasn't expecting before. And that also, certainly in the early years, back late 90s and into the change of the millennia, you could see that that was starting to become a bit of a driving factor.
This is within the individual police organisations?
Both within the international, within the Central Police Training Authority at the time, but also within forces, because don't forget that Centrex, as it was, sat alongside 43 other police forces. No central coordination, no management of it. The FCO tended, as a rule of thumb, to work to the New Scotland Yard, the Met, and as you can imagine, most of the world thought of UK policing as being New Scotland Yard. Hence the reason why today the Met actually are working hard to try and get to grips with what was a historic situation it found itself in, which was being heavily exposed to requests and deployments, not really ever coordinating it properly or making it relevant to Safer London. But they're dealing with that at the moment, but it's still a big risk. So essentially what I'm saying is there were a multitude of policing organisations essentially competing with one another to provide a response. And the way in which they provided that response was incoherent, no communication or coordination amongst ourselves, and typically, in terms of the old way of doing things, it was very much UK policing off the shelf.
So how did you attempt to coordinate and cohere what you've characterised as being a very uncoordinated and incoherent form of policing assistance?
It was very much a personal realisation when I arrived, sat behind my desk, pulled the drawer open to find nothing in there, looked at the shelf to see what policies and procedures my academy, my international faculty, as it was then called, worked to, only to discover that, you know, again, put my hand up here, you know, this is as recent as several years ago. You know, we had no procedures, we had no duty of care, we had nothing. And in fact, it was the fact that I'd come from the military into this environment where I went looking for those two or three cuddly toys that you hold on to in terms of safety ground, processes and procedures, I suddenly discovered there were none. And that's where the personal start of this journey really kicked off for me, because one of the reasons I came back into public service was this vocational issue. Can't quite put my finger on it, but I had a very vocational desire to make a difference. Knew about policing with my experiences back home in Zimbabwe and some of the issues that were happening there, was very aware of the issue around community, citizen security and the social contract. So it got kind of into that, but suddenly discovered that here I was responsible for Latin American Caribbean, which of course is geographically not the smallest of regions, with some really, really firmly established relationships with those officers and now chief constables and various executive heads of police establishments and forces, realising that actually everything was only based on the strength of a communication via email, by an odd document or two, and yet we were sending whole teams out for weeks or months at a time to involve that. And I just knew at that moment that, well, in terms of the benefit to UK taxpayers in the context of what we were trying to do, I went searching for this linkage. I wanted to know what were the primary terms of reference for deploying anywhere, whilst at the same time looking at what my internal terms of reference were in terms of just of managing my responsibilities. So actually there was a relationship to my own personal development report processes within the organisation, which all looked Gucci and all very impressive in terms of these were my personal objectives for the year, but actually they didn't tie into anything organisationally. There was no strategic link. And then at the same time, looking at the relationships we had in region where we were delivering X number of engagements, be that leadership or be it other bespoke work. And again, with no project documentation sitting behind it, it was all based on a very loose, thin thread of relationship and on the basis of reputation alone. And I knew at that moment in time that I couldn't put my hand on my heart and say, as a professional working in this environment, that I was comfortable with that. That's at the point that I started on this journey, finally, to say that it just so happened that when I came on board, probably the watershed moment for me was then being asked to attend the very first SSR practitioners course. It just so happened that that started at the same time I arrived. So for me personally, that was the key to the starting point.
So you identified fairly quickly that there was a problem with the manner in which UK policing assistance was organised. In what practical ways did you go from achieving that realisation, which I think if I get my timeline correct, was somewhere around 2003, 2004, to 2007? What changes have you worked your way through? What processes have you engaged in?
From a personal perspective, I started personally developing my own... I started researching current learning and analysis procedures. So in terms of the UK police training environment, we had our own training centre up at Harrogate. We developed a number of core systems and procedures with regards to the learning environment. So this, the Centrex was responsible for developing the UK's action-centred learning system and processes. It was developing learning needs analyses and tools and techniques. So there we were developing this, and just issued a new sort of SO, standard operating procedure, a guidebook on this. So one of the things I did is I took that guidebook, pulled out of it a number of those tools and techniques that were used here to develop training programs and processes in the UK, and started tailoring those for my own personal use coming into the job as a non-policing civilian, albeit with an operational background. So I used my operational experience from the military to kind of give me an idea of the kind of clues I was looking at in terms of the procedures I wanted, and then started to pull out of this, the UK standard procedures, what was relevant. So for me, I did something for myself within my own role within the Latin American Caribbean Department. I then made a decision and I did that for myself, but what was apparent, because there was nothing, I started very quickly getting a number of the other officers within the department, including my head of faculty as it was, taking interest in the fact that I was trying to provide some coherence to the reporting formats and stuff, and I offered up one or two ideas for process. Because again, the other officers that were working within the faculty, each were doing their own scoping studies and things in their own way. So that was the case, but of course I'm still new into the organisation. I'm not a police officer. So I've kind of given you an understanding that this was very much a personal, professional way of setting my stall out in terms of my own style. But I had to be patient. It was only basically a year or so later, managing some of the current contracts and engagements we were already engaged in, where I started applying also I started taking a much more questioning approach to the established relationships. So again, rather than us say, yes, we can do that, if we had a request to say, listen, could we, you know, thanks very much for doing that leadership program in a Caribbean island, we would like to do this now in terms of critical incident command. I very quickly was saying, but you know, in terms of who's going to take responsibility for this program when we complete it, can you give us an idea on that? I started also applying that issue of local ownership. I started asking who's going to be responsible for this on the ground. It was interesting to see the response I got. So for example, in Jamaica, where I met up with the then head of the Jamaican Staff College, who's actually back now in post because he went out and he's been doing a PhD, he went to John Jay. His name, Senior Superintendent Dormer Harrison. When Dormer and I came together at this time, You know, he knew about Bram's Hill, he knew about the reputation. He was also developing his own new Jamaican staff college strategy. Jamaican Constabulary was under a lot of pressure, huge increase in violent crime. UK itself, including the Met, had been there for a number of years trying to make a difference. I had just stumbled across an executive, There was an executive program that had been put together by DFID using, I believe at the time, I think the partner was KPMG Atos. And when we went out there to look at developing this new training program in partnership with the Staff College, when we went to do our analysis for the development of the Critical Incident Command course, one of the things we did is we went to understand who's already there. And of course, we knew that the Met were there. We knew that there was an operation on the ground there. I can't give the operation's title because it's still active. But we knew there was an operation on the ground there linked to the Safer London and the Yardie gangs. So the fact that we were going to be developing a locally owned, contextualised critical incident course for Dormer and his team and the Jamaican Constabulary, I needed to know that the relevance to what the Met were doing in terms of dealing with some of these very live operational issues could be somehow mapped in. So we went and interviewed them. And it was then that I discovered that this, coming back to the executive program, that there had been this four-year strategic program taking place within the Jamaican Staff College, within the Jamaican Constabulary headquarters, only to discover that it had been 4 years in the making. I understand it cost in the region of £4 million had been invested in it, and not one of the senior operational team within the Jamaican Constabulary had ever been consulted by this project, which I found
this was a UK project.
UK project. So straight away, what I was aware of is that, you know, it wasn't being there was no police involvement. This was done through a consultancy as part of a DFID development program of some description, and I can't remember the original terms of reference. But what I did know is I came across it, got to know that there were some officers, that there were some consultants involved, because we went to see them and said, this is what we're developing, we're interested in what you've done. And it was interesting because the mechanics to that engagement was very telling for me, and it reiterated part of the context, because actually they didn't want to know. So when we went there to say, listen, we're developing something here for the Constabulary, we think it can be aligned to the work you're doing, we're certainly interested in what you're doing, here's a report of our terms of reference, and there was no, you know, this is us talking to other UK officials, there was no openness. To the contrary, there was very much a wall being put up that we don't want to get involved with you guys. Yet at the same time, we spoke to the Met team and they were very interested, so much so that they provided up live operational programs to use as paper feeds on the Critical Incident Command course. So on the one hand, we were suddenly achieving something that had not been done in our engagements before, which is that we were joining up with some other operations. And yet, right as we were doing this, we knew that there was a strategic program taking place that wanted nothing to do with anybody. And this included the Met operation. They knew nothing about it. I think that was the starting point for me to look into this in more detail about the lack of coordination. So coming back to your question, about how we get engaged, it was interesting that by applying the processes I'd sort of tailored from our own UK approach to training analysis, etc., I was starting to unearth some glaring gaps in the way people communicated on the ground in delivery of what a HMG was trying to do.
You alluded to this, but I want to just zero in on it a little bit, which is that there seemed to be some resistance from various quarters. Perhaps you used the Jamaica example, but there may be other cases that you may wish to reflect upon. Resistance to your attempts to coordinate and cohere what you described as a uncoordinated and incoherent system.
Well, let's get to the heart of the matter. In the first few months and year or so of being on the ground in a variety of Caribbean countries, as a non-departmental public body, which is what the agency was, but we were still a government agency, I regarded myself as a civil servant representing UK policing, not just Centrex, and I was there on behalf of government. I was going to a number of meetings, including some of the niceties, going to the odd ambassador's dinner or cocktail party. I was actually having to justify who I was to UK embassy officials, because they had been told that Centrex was a commercial company. We were only there to create to make money, and that in fact anything that I had to say or do could be disregarded. In other words, what I discovered was that the Caribbean was latticed with a number of retired officers and other individuals, all purporting to represent UK policing and current thinking, and yet who seemed to be there as part of their own agenda. It didn't seem to tie into anything. And as I said, from an ethical point of view, I had not one, but I had several conversations where I found myself having to reassure the ambassador that this is who I was, that I had a legitimate role out there, that I was genuinely trying to tie this into UK policy as it was for whatever country it was. And yet at the same time was having to have private discussions with these same individuals to say, on what basis are they basically bad-mouthing a UK government institution? And what I discovered was that, of course, this reticence to engage with us was very much because, you know, we were seen as an arm of policing which wasn't ourselves joined up, and that in fact, you know, we had nothing to offer. We were just there to make money, and that created very much the impetus for me to start to try and work through this.
So, I mean, what strategies did you use to actually work through this? I mean, you mentioned the difficult. It might be a personal case that you might reflect on. It might be a case of working as part of Centrex with another institution. But how did you overcome what you're describing as the sort of everyday resistance that you encountered at various different levels in the Caribbean where you were working?
The first one was based on stakeholder analysis. As soon as I started to realise the complexity to this informal arrangement as I saw it, I spent a lot of time researching either through the established networks, and by that I mean the desk officers in London in the Foreign Office, through DFID contacts, etc. I started to follow the audit trail of people and communications in order to try and understand who was representing what. The key starting point in all of this was the Foreign Office. It was DFID, and in particular the policing advisors. The majority, I think everyone that I came across at the time was a retired police officer. And you had one that was based in America as the overseas territory advisor. We had another officer, former Met officer, working for the Foreign Office Caribbean Department, both of whom personally were super, and in fact were very much focused on providing a coherent and professional response in terms of their job to that desk. But they themselves, because they knew they couldn't turn to UK policing, and here I just highlight the issue that this is where UK policing has to hold up its hand, they knew that they couldn't come to the system and ask for support in any form of coherent way. They knew that to get anything done in terms of any policing engagement, they would have to go to their own little black book and develop, you know, their network. But that network did include a number of forces. So in the context of the Foreign Office advisor, of course, he knew that he still had all of his established contacts within the Met. That's the Metropolitan Police. And in many cases, they themselves, without any having particularly good coordination, internal coordination processes, they were providing officers on a number of occasions. So in terms of research of the stakeholders, that was the key to it, because it was then that I realised the amount of complexity there was to the stakeholder network within policing, how informal it was, and yet at the same time, it kind of was formalised because you had police advisers both within the Foreign Office, you had police advisers within DFID, you had police advisers within the MOD, Security Sector Defence Advisory Team, you had not one but several departments within the FCO who had policing advisers. We also had the Home Office International Directorate with policing advisers. And then you had a range of consultants or former policing advisers, and you now had, and this was back 2003-2004, you also had two or three organisations, as they were then called, such as Ramesses, IODA, Dream Policing, to name but three, who were also looking to provide service and capacity and resource to UK policing projects. But all of that was disconnected. It all worked in its own independent sphere.
Is it any more connected currently?
No. I say no. Paul Kernahan sits as the international portfolio holder within the Association of Chief Police Officers, ACPO. So Paul Kernahan is a chief constable of one of the largest forces in the country, Hampshire. I think it's one of the largest constabularies in the country. So he's a full-time chief constable, and yet he has the international portfolio holder. He has no staff or executive to support him in fulfilling that function. He is a chief officer of a whole constabulary. He raised a number of years ago, 2002, 2003. In fact, he did a couple of papers that he published both here with, I believe it was with the Defence Academy. He also published a couple of papers within government highlighting his concerns around the then call for UK policing to support deployments like Kosovo and other PSO, peace support operations. So he is already flagged up then that he needed to have provide a more coherent response. He had put out the call to the service. The service at the time, still then, said, yeah, we can do a little bit about this, but to be honest, our focus is here in Nottingham, or it's here in London, or it's here wherever. It was very parochial. So he raised the issue then. Certainly, we had started raising the issue that somehow we needed to take the UK contribution here a little bit more seriously. And the reality is that from that moment to the review that Sir Ronnie Flanagan did earlier this year, who's Chief HMIC, in other words, he's the head of Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, which is an oversight body, tripartite oversight body. He did a review on international policing, a very quick and dirty review, but it was reasonably comprehensive in the sense that he picked out the key issues, which is UK policing is increasingly being asked to engage overseas. It still has no internal process. It's still not coordinated. And in fact, we need to deal with this issue that culturally, any UK officer today, it's still regarded as a black mark in his book or her book if they commit themselves to any overseas work. In other words, their promotion is at risk if they do volunteer for such work. That's the situation, and that is still relevant today. Now, Sir Ronnie's paper review took place earlier this year. Fortunately, coming back to where I feel as though I've been influencing the agenda from behind the scenes, is that the MPIA were given the task by the Home Office to now go and to scope the concept of an International Policing Assistance Board, which would become an official oversight body, police-owned and police-led, that would be co-chaired, potentially between ACPO, I referred to earlier on, and FCO, and also the creation of an International Policing Assistance Group, an IPAG, that would be the sort of the executive body that implements key decisions, etc. Now, this is a very bold, brave new suggestion. We're actually undertaking that review, and the findings are due out at the end of December 2007. And this is also in response to the fact that the FCO, who do, as I mentioned earlier, have this internal policing advisory capacity, well, their key capacity sits within what they call the Conflict Issues Group. And for this last several years, they have been responsible for liaising with the Home Office in providing UK officers to deployments within the peace support operations environment. And by that, I mean Iraq and Afghanistan, but also Kosovo and one or two other areas in that environment. They've coordinated it and have been managing that for a few years. But they themselves are realise how burdensome it is to try and work within the policing environment, not being from the police. And part of what Sir Ronnie was suggesting is that the FCO look at relinquishing that responsibility back to the police service and then to rethink how we can bring this back together in a more joined up way. So you ask the question, and the issue is today, right here and now, at this interview, it's still uncoordinated. But I do believe that behind the scenes, you know, and certainly from the MPIA's perspective and my perspective, we now have firmly established relationships developing with the Home Office, with the Met, with ACPO, with PSNI, with Tully Allen, which is the Police Staff College in Scotland.
And PSNI being Police Service in Northern Ireland.
Correct. And that's their college, including their the PRRT. And I know what you're going to ask me, which is what the PR... which is the... it's the police... recruitment and rehabilitation unit or team. It's all post pattern. It's a response to giving opportunities to former RUC officers to continue to be involved in policing. But that's another institution. We have now, over this last 2 years, established relationships with all of these persons. They have all been very active participants this year in the scoping review and are all very keen that we use the Sir Ronnie's paper and this as the opportunity to set down some firm terms of reference. So, no, possibly tomorrow.
Okay. I'd like to move on to talking about, from sort of policing in a sort of a very broad context, to something discussing in particular some of the training programs that you've been involved in. So what we're sort of interested in looking at, some of the detail. What were the programs? How did you develop them? How did you teach on them? How did you instruct on them? What was the follow-up, etc.? So, with your permission, we'll move on to that. I know that from your description earlier that you've been involved in a lot of police training programs overseas. It might be worthwhile just to reflect upon one of the programs that stands out for you, and talking it through, how you conceptualise the need for a program, all the way down to delivering the program and beyond.
The first and most important part of what we do now, as perhaps compared to a few years ago, is that this has to be aligned with a core UK policing or government objective. Of course, it's quite difficult to justify. It's quite difficult to justify a policing requirement to go into a country, and typically we don't do that now, unless we're approached direct by a state. And I can give an example of that afterwards. But the best example in terms of government's approach is to do with Mexico, which is an interesting case in point because obviously Mexico isn't a former Commonwealth country, etc. It's kind of, whilst it sits there as a country that the UK are very keen to engage with, we actually have close relationships with Mexico through the High Commission. The Latin American Caribbean Department had an opportunity to engage with the Mexican government, federal government, to look at the concept of UK community policing. That was their interest, and at the time on the ground from the Foreign Office perspective, they were interested in looking at this from a policing perspective. Now, the Foreign Office got in touch with us and they said, this is what we're interested in, and not only are we interested in it, but we do believe that it fits into an area of the new security sector reform strategies that were being banded around the various departments. And in particular, in this respect, the fact that funds were being made available to the High Commission in Mexico to look at maybe pilot projects in a variety of areas. And this was one that interested them. The fact that the UK is an international lead in community policing, when they got in touch with us, what we wanted to understand is, you know, there's one thing saying that they're interested in community policing. It's another thing understanding where this was going to go in terms of the long-term objective. It was clear that from the President's office, from a federal perspective, the Mexican government wanted to find ways and means with which it could improve its trust and effectiveness with the community. There are a number of pressures within Mexico, notwithstanding the issues around guns and gangs, people trafficking, and some of the internal economic situation. But in particular, the federal government and the federal institutions felt that they were losing a grip on this trust aspect and wanted to look at it this. They had heard and researched themselves issues around British community policing, around the concept of partnerships, and were very interested in it. So that's kind of where we set the scene. When it came to us, of course, the first thing we did was said, well, we would need to go and interview a number of people. Now that we understood the sort of the overarching rationale behind it, in close cooperation with the High Commission, we then looked at developing a project plan. At that time, you needed to have it associated with what the funding, the bid process. So the High Commission worked with us to develop a response to the tender, which was all associated with accessing funding from the Global Conflict Prevention Pool, as it was called. And it was at that stage that you align your initial aims and objectives, but you kept it phased. It was a phased approach. In other words, what we focused on was an engagement to go and do the assessment around the feasibility and credibility of this request. No, we didn't want to commit to a longer term strategy, nothing. We needed to know that there was something in this and that the UK were happy with that from head office here in London. It met the requirements of the High Commission, but more specifically, we had teased out of the federal government exactly what it is they thought they were after with this whole trust thing and the community policing. We submitted that in terms of our new processes. We submitted that to the FCO, who, in consultation with the federal government, agreed that this was, you know, that they wanted to move forward, and we did. And basically, they gave the thumbs up, and we went and did this analysis. What was interesting was our suggestion was that we run a pilot scheme in one or two states, and that came out of the initial scoping deployment, actually.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what did the initial scoping deployment consist of, how long did it take, who was involved, not the names, but sort of how you went about identifying the need for this, or confirming that there was a need?
Well, the initial phase of confirmation is to do with the initial tender and the project plan as it was put down. So we had that signed up to by the various stakeholders. Once we had that confirmed and signed off by the Foreign Office in terms of a contractual arrangement, because that's how it works within the system, we then selected two individuals. One was the regional training coordinator. Now, I had initiated it, but I'd handed over at this stage because I'd been involved in the initial discussions. But at this stage, the new training coordinator was involved, and we, within the policing organisation, we sought a community policing expert from within the Leadership Academy, the International Academy, who had the prerequisite skills and competencies to go and ask the right kind of questions. We also established and designed a questionnaire to take out with us, which we had sent ahead of us. So we also wanted this, because we needed this to be translated. We also needed to get very early on some local response to some of the questions. And that was where the Foreign Office played a big role. Because what we wanted them to do is, we didn't want to arrive there and the questions not be understood, or if there were any red flags from the local perspective, for them to raise those very early on. Because one of the things we had seen before, we had followed process, we had deployed, and suddenly discovered that it was actually half of what you were there to question created some tension or was misunderstood. So we'd sent this all ahead of us. Those two individuals went with a very set agenda. The various interviews and everything were established, and by that stage it had been agreed that there was going to be two states involved. So we were looking at Aguascalientes and Chihuahua were the two states that were the objective. But at this point, the other issue that we recommended from a training institution's perspective, and this gives you your first indication of how we were starting to turn the approach from a training, an international training perspective, we also said that right at the outset, whether the scoping review comes back with a positive, yes, we know how we're going to do this, and let's crack on to phase two, or not, we made them understand that we expected a we expected a group of senior, credible officers to be pre-selected within those states to be not only heavily involved in the interview process, but to be the initial and provisional candidates for joining the project team, the training program itself. In other words, we right at the outset, we said, we need you to think about how you're going to own and take this forward in the long term, if this comes to pass. And that seemed to, it was interesting, because the Mexicans' response to that was, that's something unusual, because normally we get told how to fit in, because I think they'd had a lot of experience with ILEA, that's the International Law Enforcement Agency, the American training institution that has offices all around the world. They're used to quite a prescriptive approach. So this was new, because we were now saying to them, we needed to think carefully about who's going to be involved, because those people will play a part in owning this later on. We went and did the interviews, and the recommendation that came out of the interview, to bring this bit to a close, was that, yes, indeed, they felt that the principles of UK community policing, tailored to their own requirements, would enable there to be some movement in this overall objective by the federal government. The other key decision that came out of the scoping review is that the contextualization of this community strategy needed to be designed by the Mexican teams that were selected in those two states. And it was agreed as a project from the outset that they would be brought here to the UK to be taken away from their environment, given an opportunity and the space to work with our community policing training experts to lead on the design of what they thought was suitable to them. And we came back from the review, set these as the recommendations, and that was agreed to very, very quickly. And I think the reason it was turned around so quickly was not so much a time issue as a fact that they were very clearly, I felt that they trusted the process right at the outset, the fact we'd asked them to give some local feedback to the questionnaires, etc. And the upshot of that was that we actually had four officers selected from each of the states, so that was eight in total, which included two female officers, were brought to the UK, and they spent a month in the UK at Bramshill at the Staff College, and for a month working with our teams, went out practically to experience community policing in action here in the UK, gathered a lot of information themselves, and facilitated by our training experts, then proceeded to design a bespoke training engagement to roll out in those two states. Also embedded in that design by the end of that period here in the UK was an evaluation process was designed that wasn't just a level one, but it was actually a level one to level three evaluation.
What do you mean by level one to level
three? Level one, generally speaking, means the what we call the happy sheet. So at the end of a week's training session, people fill in their sheets and say yay or nay or put comments down, etc. Level two is one where you go back several months later to actually see how the training that was, you know, had been implemented, any impact it had had in terms of the students that had been through it and with the trainers that took part in it. Level three is one where it's a level beyond that, which is, say, a year later, you actually go back, you revisit the areas where the training took place to actually look at the difference it made within the workplace in terms of empirical data. And level three was the one where we were then going to, and this remained core to the actual design of the whole process, that by the end of the week, everyone understood at that stage that we were going to be back in 6 months' time in Mexico after seeing the programs being delivered. And we were then going to ask them in 12 months' time, that same team, to come and provide the feedback at a national seminar chaired by the federal institution And that they would lead and deliver the data back from those pilot projects. We would facilitate it, but they would provide the feedback. So you can see straight away what we developed, in fact, ended up being a five-phase engagement. Phase one, the dealing with the initial approach, linking it to the UK policing the UK Foreign Office's strategy in terms of engagement. Phase two was the scoping review itself. Phase three was the delivery of the training that took part, phase one was the initial project being set up. Phase two was the scope out in Mexico. Phase three was the bespoke training engagement here in the UK to design the program. This was the month-long program. Phase four was their delivery of that program. And then phase five had the two parts to it, which was a six-month evaluation and then the national seminar.
So all said and told, from the initial approach until the end of the level three evaluation and stage five, how long did this process take? How many people would have been involved in this process?
It's taken 2 years. So the national seminar was completed last month, October 2007. And essentially, it kicked off in the fall of 2005. So it's taken 2 years. From the UK policing perspective, we've probably used, I would say there've been up to 7 or 8 key staff and officers involved within the agency. But of course, there's been a number of forces that were involved in terms of visits. But the core staff that were involved in doing the programme here and then going out to help facilitate delivery and then the eventual evaluations, about 7 or 8 of us in total. But from the FCO's perspective, they had a project manager nominated within the High Commission. It was joined up with the FCO teams back here in London, so there was the procurement and all of that were involved. But from the Mexicans' perspective, you essentially had this cohort of 4 senior officers who were basically trained as trainers, as well as taken through the design process because they had responsibility for it, and who were now in ownership of those programs. So you had those 8 in total delivering this program across each of the states, the Escalientes and Chihuahua, which themselves involved a number of precincts. And then, as I say, the final phase, which took place last month, we're waiting for the evaluation to come back. Suffice to say that the federal government were delighted with what they were hearing in terms of that this could work. The other point I must add, which I didn't at that stage, is that we discovered that the FCO had also been, when I say piloting, they had been doing a small amount of restorative justice engagement. And just to highlight my point earlier on with coordination, which, believe it or not, Surrey Police had been providing an officer, an expert within restorative police, had been working on his own as part of a separate project during this period.
So how did you find out about that project?
Because we bumped into him in the High Commission. As soon as we discovered he was there, involved in restorative justice, which, guess what, has a connection with the community, partnerships, etc., very quickly, we approached Surrey Police and said, can we have your person involved in this whole project and get this aligned? To which, of course, Surrey Police said, no, that's fine, but, you know, we did that because, you know, we do have a lead here in the UK in terms of looking at this restorative justice process. That's why we've been here in country for a couple of years. But we had no idea. And unless we'd bumped into that person, we'd never have known. My point being that because we stumbled across this person midway through the project, it enabled us very quickly to then align aspects to the justice sector bit that he was doing with restorative justice, and we got them to co-present their work at the same seminar. So by default, we managed to provide a very coordinated, joined-up response. And as I said, going back to the initial feedback, it's been very positive. But we were directly approached by not one, but 10 of the Mexican states to look at potentially running a similar program for them. Of course, one of the responses we now have to make is, okay, not so much that's great, that's new business, which is perhaps the old way of looking at this, which is one of the concerns I've always had, It's a case of, well, if we believe that this is going to improve policing in this part of the world, if through the FCO we can make this align to an improved relationship with Mexico, we know that Mexico is one of the transit routes with regards issues of small arms, light weapons. We know there's connections there with regards tourism to us in the UK, and we know that there are big concerns around the influence of gangs there and the threat that that creates. You know, again, we would need to apply the criteria. But at this moment in time, it looks as though that is a project that has not only got legs on it, I think it has actually delivered something that is practically locally owned and is effective in its initial engagement. But that's the completion of an initial project that's taken 2 years. And that, so essentially what I'm saying is this is the end of a 2-year pilot project. Mm. It's only now that we may see this run out as part of a more, you know, a broader, longer-term project.
You mentioned the two states in which you are working, and then you also mentioned that there's 10 other states which have approached you subsequently. I'd like to ask you a little question about what the decision was to pilot in those two states as opposed to two other states. Why focus in these two states and where other parts of the country unaffected? So were strategies different in one state as opposed to the other of the two states? A series of questions really getting at some of the sort of complexities of programming, program decision making, and differences between the two states and the other states, and between Chihuahua and Aguascalientes.
That responsibility lies firmly with the Foreign Office. So to make clear, we're not involved in the decision-making around the states, and that was understood by all parties right at the outset. What I do understand in terms of my knowledge of the project is that, in fact, the reason those two states ended up appearing large on the High Commission's radar in terms of potential programs is, in fact, due to personality of the attorney generals within those two states. One was a woman, one was a man. The woman in particular, and I can't remember her name, I think she had a vision. I think she understood that there was something in this, but I also understand from the relationships we developed within those states, you know, she is very politically motivated as well. My point being that the criteria that are applied by High Commission, not quite sure how they apply it, but what I do understand is that they found an easy door, open door, as a result of those relationships with two quite political figures. Because one of the other benefits or outputs from the project to date has been the fact that this has been a joint policing and fiscales, the judicial side. We've had the justice sector very much engaged in this project as well, and they were there at the seminar. So that was one of the attorney generals that we met, particularly out in Mexico when it was on the media, etc. You could see very quickly that they were using this as a political tool to advocate better community relationships and trying to make a difference in improving their responsibility to the communities within it.
I'd like to ask a question, which is sort of began by asking this before we meandered into what I think have been very interesting, which is about context. You mentioned the UK policing advisor that was an expert in community policing. And you mentioned your training advisor who had that portfolio for that particular region, and those were the two lead people from your agency that were involved in developing the project. You then mentioned the other people that were involved whenever the Mexican senior officers came to Bratton's Hill. So my question really is, how did you and how did your fellow officers come to familiarize yourselves with the political nuances of these two states? The politics of these states, the structures of these states, but also the language of the states. Was there a language barrier that you had to overcome when designing and thinking through this programming?
In practical terms, Obviously, we do a degree of research before we get involved. So when we get the first inquiry or approach, particularly from UK government or indeed a direct state request, you know, the team and the desks are responsible for researching. That researching is then supported and enhanced by the role of the High Commission. So that relationship. So in terms of the nuances and the politics involved and perhaps some of the relationships involved, we have to take, by definition, we have to take our lead from the High Commission. That's our local knowledge as best we have it, prior to eventually developing the relationships within force. What is interesting, though, that as soon as we do get in on the ground, particularly in the context of having uniformed officers on the ground taking part in the scoping study or, in fact, in direct delivery or facilitating the delivery of training, what you will find all around the world, and we did in Mexico, the moment they know that they're speaking to a fellow officer, there you found that there was the barriers that are always there when we go into any country. There are inherent social and psychological barriers that exist between one individual and another. The only reason I could get around those barriers, just going back to my own personal experience as a training coordinator, not being an officer, was because of my operational background. So I would have to use the tool that I had actually been in the military and understood operational context as my lever in.
To grind legitimacy for yourself.
And I found that was really, I would have to do that literally the day I got off the plane. With any person within the police establishment that I was engaging with who saw me potentially as another consultant, because this was the phrase, you know, they were, generally speaking, they were not and would never fully engage in the way you would expect them to engage with anybody who they felt couldn't speak the language or understand the context from an operational perspective. So going back to my point about our team, it was when the team very quickly, you know, reassured their colleagues that here they are, it was police to police, that they would then confirm, they would then find themselves over a beer, the whole social interaction bit, confirming what we had already been told by the High Commission. So that's one of the ways, in other words, we did a bit of backward research to make sure that what the High Commission had told us actually made sense. And generally speaking, it was there, but you would always find out there were one or two bits which the High Commission would never know, because of course, you know, they are seen as the British High Commission. So it was only once you're in amongst the team and starting to roll up your sleeves and get involved in training or scoping and asking some of the questions on your own in isolation that you would get to know some of the real nuances and challenges. So the context in that respect was very much around the operational connection.
So, I mean, what, for example, did you not know that you found out through this back channel research?
We knew that, well, you would know very quickly the fact that the credibility of the selection process, in other words, the teams that were selected within for the project, the credibility of that process, the comprehensiveness of that process was suspect. And I would generally say that in this respect, we were quite lucky. We only had two out of the eight who quite clearly were not suitable for the project. But that's not to say that they, you know, we had been committed, and that because it was led by our Mexican colleague. But you would find out issues around the nature of the people that you were going to be working with. You would also find out issues behind the scenes about the practicalities of delivering training, the resources, the facilities and stuff like that. You would get to understand how to work with those through the scoping study and on the ground, which you wouldn't have got through the High Commission, because they wouldn't have been able to tell you, you know, what to look for in terms of physical capability. The other issues were around the politics of it. So we got to know more about the two officials, you know, that were leading this project in terms of the Attorney General, etc. We got to understand the mechanics of that and the politics behind that. And that enabled us to, particularly in terms of when we established the aims and objectives of the community project, and in particular how that was to be communicated to the media, who were very interested in it locally, we only got that through the relationship with the the police teams that we were working with, not through the High Commission per se. Does that help give you an idea?
That does, and it prompts another question, which is, in what language were these interactions taking place?
Sorry,
how did you circumnavigate or circumvent any potential lost in translation problems, any language difficulties that you may have had between English and Spanish?
Yeah, we use translators. And the one thing I would say that the UK style of police training, which is this action-centred, student-centred approach, action-learning, student-centred approach, which is it's very interactive, but it's very deliberate. It's very focused on it, making sure that people have understood the question, and because of the interactiveness of it, in other words, less reliance on PowerPoints and more on the engagement, testing and adjusting with the questioning, and our experience in working with translators, both here in the UK as well as overseas, we've developed a way of delivering training through translation, which we think works very well, and we don't have a problem with. So in terms of this Mexican project, it was delivered through translation.
Thank you. I mean, you've been very helpful in giving a very specific and very detailed case of good practice where a training program was conceptual, was from its origins and all the various stages in which it progressed through, and all the issues that you had to work your way through in order to make it remain what was a good idea at the beginning, remain a good idea two years on. I wonder if I can ask you to press you a little bit to talk about cases where there was maybe a bad practice of less good practice in which you've been involved in training programs where maybe the idea was not good, or the execution or the development of the idea was not good, or the execution of it was poor. So in a similar way to the manner in which you've talked, really walked us through these various phases in the Mexico project, is there any examples of less good practice that spring to mind?
There's two. There's two examples. The one I'll keep very brief, because essentially it's just to outline some of the pitfalls were that a lot of UK police institutions that have been engaged with, including government itself in terms of projects overseas, was one to do with the Lesotho Access to Justice program. Without going into detail, it was a long program, 4 years.
Which years were they?
And this was 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. I think it was 2002 through to 2007, and the program has was actually closed this year by DFID prior to completion for a variety of reasons, notwithstanding the fact that there'd been a review across a number of projects in Africa across the whole DFID project, but that with regards to this particular project, they felt that DFID had closed it prematurely because they felt that there was not enough progress in enough of the areas of the project. So in terms of what I'm getting at with regards to the Lesotho project was that there we were as a small international faculty working within the then Central Police Training Development Authority, being asked to get involved in an access to justice program overseas. We had no inherent experience in this respect. We had no expertise within the department in this respect. We certainly had never done a project of this complexity before, although there were one or two bits in there, like leadership and things, that we knew we could do. And by default, because of the fact that we ourselves, along with many other policing groups around the country who have been involved in international policing, we find ourselves falling into a project. Not only falling into it, but actually putting ourselves up to project manager. And this project wasn't just policing. It was to do with the courts. It was to do with HIV/AIDS. It was to do with aspects of sort of connected to local education and community partnerships. So there was a project that was massive in its complexity. There was a lot of monies involved. It was going to involve establishing in-country project managers, not just doing this remotely. It was being run by a team that was based in Pretoria, not in Lesotho. So there was distance between the course sponsor, there was distance between us as a training institution, but that's a training institution that's now saying it can project manage what is inherently a long-term complex project. Well, the upshot of it is that I think we achieved 50% of the stuff that we were asked to do as part of the project very well and very effectively. But guess what? That was connected to the policing bits that we knew and well and trusted and we worked hard to engage with. I would say 50% of the project fell between the stools. We ultimately had a responsibility for that, and whilst we tried to manage it as best we could, we discovered that the process of the project being sponsored and co-run from elsewhere meant that between us all, I think we were all complicit in what essentially was an incomplete project. I think we did achieve certain things, and they are being, we know, in terms of we've maintained relationships with those out there, but we missed an opportunity because of that. So that was just very quickly to give you an understanding that, and I still believe it's happening today. I still believe that the UK government are committing themselves to some significant major programmes that not only are complex, that have implicit policing terms of reference in it, that they have no idea in terms of the resilience how this is going to be coordinated over the long term. But that's one issue there. The more specific one in terms of things, I would say didn't work out the way I would like it to have worked out in terms of our involvement, applying the principles of security sector reform again, this concept of SSR, was our initial engagement in Central America, where again we had a relationship that was established with the ANSP. I can't give you the full titles. You would need to think about that in more detail.